Good morning. Thank you for being here. I appreciate so much the presence of each and every one of you. And before we get started, I want to thank all of you that came yesterday. I'm sorry I missed that. I was in Cincinnati taking care of Dad, who's doing some better. As Terry mentioned, I told a story. He was a little feisty, wanting to get out and run around yesterday, which is a lot more than he's done the last several weekends when I've been up there. So he's continuing to improve, and hopefully over the next little bit, we'll have some surgery scheduled and get him back on the mend. Appreciate your thoughts and prayers on his behalf as well. If you will open your Bibles with me to Acts chapter 16. And in Acts chapter 16, we find Paul here on his second missionary journey about midway through and comes to the city of Philippi. And Philippi is a famous city in classic history. It's the site of a very famous battle between both Octavius when he met Brutus and Cassius, in terrible conflict there in the expansion of the Roman Empire. And while it brought the end of two Republican generals that day and opened up this part of the Roman Empire for their conquest, most times when we think of effective conquest, the world's minds go to these military conflicts when things are conquered. But here in Acts chapter 16, we see the first converts in Europe. Europe begins to be conquered, spiritually speaking, when the first converts are found. When the first work begins, and as we learn later in the letter that Paul writes back to the church at Philippi, one of the strongest, soundest, most devout congregations that we read about in all of the New Testament. As you read the book of Philippians, you find very few, if any, real problems that Paul's trying to correct. Now, put that against the church at Corinth and all the problems Paul's correcting. Or even the churches in Galatia with their corrections. And it goes on to Thessalonica and all of the letters that Paul writes back. There's so many problems that he's trying to fix and correct. But Philippi, this church, which is founded in some strange ways that we're going to look at this morning, with a very myriad cast of characters, this is the one that gets it right, if you will. That's firm and that's established. I want us to begin a series today where we look at some lessons from various cases of conversion. This morning, we're going to look at some lessons from Lydia. And over the next several weeks, we're going to take a look at various conversions, how they happened, how they took place, and some lessons that we can glean from them, as we better understand what happened and the ramifications of what happened with each of these characters that we're introduced to throughout the book of Acts. I'm going to give a quick disclaimer here because my OCD may drive me nuts through this. We've been having some PowerPoint problems this morning, and if you notice some frustration, it's between me and PowerPoint. And I'm going to try to not let that get in the way of this lesson. But there's just some things that it's not doing that it should be doing. So let's get past that. So in Acts chapter 16, down around verse 13, we have Paul, and I believe based on the writing, Luke's there with him. And they go to a riverbank and find these women that are there praying. And one of the women is a woman named Lydia. And we've learned that Lydia is a seller of purple, and she's from Thyatira. A couple of things very interesting about this. She's from Thyatira. Now, just a little bit ago, about a chapter before, that was the direction that Paul and his group was heading. But yet, he was stopped by the Spirit, and he had the famous Macedonian call as he goes out into Macedonia. Paul was on his way in the region where he would have found her in Thyatira, but yet was stopped. It's interesting that though she's from Thyatira, she finds herself in Philippi and finds herself in the place where Paul is teaching. Wouldn't have been able had she not ended up in Philippi. Why she was in Philippi, I don't know. The journey from Thyatira to Philippi is not a difficult one. Historically speaking, Philippi would have been a major trading place. And those from Thyatira, especially the women, looking back historically from the days of Homer, had perfected this ability to dye in purple. So dyeing in purple, we look at that today and I think we struggle with this idea. I mean, there's several wearing purple here this morning that it's difficult. But in that time, purple was one, very rare, and two, very difficult to come up with. It was a difficult process, very labor-intensive, and it was very unique for those that were able to dye in purple. So the region here in Thyatira was well known for this. This was part of kind of who they were. Now, if she's traveling to Philippi in order to sell goods, in order to sell her purple, and is going to be there for a few weeks or months and then go back home, she finds herself, while she's there, going to a place of prayer. Interesting point here, too, that Lydia would have been a very devout woman, right? There are no synagogues in Philippi. Notice how Paul and his traveling companions, where do they go when they get to town? Go to the synagogue. Go and find people that worship. We don't ever see them end up in a synagogue in Philippi, do we? No, because there isn't one. There are not anyone there that is following and worshiping God and set up and establish worship. So down by the river, by all accounts, it's Lydia and some other women that are having time for prayer. So here's a woman that is devout to God, heart prepared to God, and wants to spend time in worship to God. Now, Paul goes down there, and it's interesting the way the verses read here. He assumes that there'll be people there praying. Make an assumption. Let's go down here and see who's by this river and who's praying, who's seeking God, in order that they might talk with them, in order that they might teach them. Paul, on his journey, on each one of these journeys, is always looking for those that are searching and then goes on and pushes a little bit further to those maybe that aren't searching and challenges their faith. But here we find Paul coming into contact with Lydia here. Interesting to note as we read the verses that... Verse 14, one who heard us was a woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple goods, who was a worshiper of God. And the Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. And after she was baptized and her household as well, she urged us, saying, if you have judged me faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. And she prevailed upon us. Interesting to note here, her heart is opened to hear. She's ready. She's prepared herself. She's seeking God. She's worshiping. She's looking. Some people in life are like that. Other people, when they're out of town on business, on vacation, have no desire to go and worship. When they take vacation from everything. You know, I'm not working this week. I'm not doing anything this week. I'm not going to go worship. I'm going to spend my Sunday sleeping in or doing whatever else. But she's not at her home congregation or with her home group, or she didn't even go to the nice big church that was in town. She's by all accounts with a couple of other women down by a river doing their best just to pray to God. Doing their best to come together and to support each other. It's interesting that there's where she finds the gospel. There's where she has an opportunity to come in contact with Paul. I'm wondering if she is one of the sellers that's in the marketplace. Remember, if we read on through Acts chapter 16, There's a demonic girl who's following them around in the marketplace. Paul casts out the demon. Her owners get mad, and that's how he ends up in jail and meeting the Philippian jailer, right? We remember that story. Now, I want us to consider that if Lydia was in town in the marketplace when Paul causes this disruption and ends up getting beaten, she's probably not going to go and talk to him and find out what was going on. That doesn't seem to be her disposition. She's one that's more prepared and looking to worship, and in worship at that time finds this opportunity. My friends, I'm persuaded that this is what providence looks like. We don't see God miraculously moving waters and waves, but she's at the right place at the right time and the right opportunity, and her heart and her mind is right to receive what she's taught. That's what providence looks like. We struggle with providence in our own lives because I think we want to see God part the Red Sea and us walk through it. Instead of what oftentimes, if we're reading this and not paying attention, all these things we call what? Coincidence. Just a coincidence. Just happen chance. That, you know, she just kind of ended up at that church or by that river while Paul just happened to be coming through town. And all this stuff is just luck or chance or coincidence. I'm persuaded that our God doesn't work that way. That if we're honest with the way things work and move, that while Paul would have never been able to get, and never did through any of the rest of his journeys, get to Thyatira where she was, here we had an opportunity while she's traveling on business to have the gospel. And notice the reaction. Once, was she the only one saved? No, it's her and her household. So do you think when they went back home to Thyatira that they forgot about what they learned? Or do you think based on her disposition, based on her, as the scripture reads, she urged us and prevailed upon us. Does it sound like somebody that's going to keep quiet about what they just heard, what they just experienced, what they just went through? She is going to be a big part of the spread of the gospel back in Thyatira. She's going to be a big part of that because her life was changed because she was ready for it. I want to give us a little bit of a contrast too. We talked about the jailer. Notice how the jailer is a very, very different story. Notice how instead of this woman who's devout and prepared and looking to pray and searching for God and trying to do what's right, we got this old rough soldier. Let's understand for a minute just how you get to become a jailer. A jailer is the cushy job you get after being a really good soldier. If you're a really good Roman soldier and you've done your duty in battle and you've done all the right things and you're toward the end of your career and you're no longer fit to be out on the front lines for battle, you get a job as a jailer. Jailer is a good job. Why is a jailer a good job? You got a house right next to the jail that's provided by the government. They take care of all your meals. They take care of you. It's a nice little retirement package. And your only job is to take care and make sure that the prisoners are still there. You got to watch over them. Notice how when we get a little bit of insight in this jailer on the front end, that as they turned him over, after beating him, turned him over, that the jailer took them and put them in the inner room. That was a jailer's call, right? How easily does this rough old soldier who's been told that these guys are going against the Roman government, whom he works for, you think he laid those cuffs on them nice and easy? Or you think he slapped them on pretty tight? Put them in those stocks in the inner part of the jail. I think he was probably a little rough around the edges. He was not looking to have a conversation with either one of these guys. He didn't want to talk to them and get their side of the story. He didn't want to find out why people were upset with them or how they even ended up in jail. The jailer didn't sit down and say, you know, boys, you look like a couple of nice guys. How'd you end up in here? He locked them in the jail and went to bed. The jailer, as we learn just looking through this, has no desire for spiritual things in life. How do we know that? Well, notice that when confronted with a brutal fact that the prisoners were gone, he didn't know the truth, but he thought the brutal fact is the prisoners are gone. Did he cry out to any deity? Did he say, oh, Zeus or Poseidon or anybody else? No. He said, my employer's not going to be happy with me, so I'm going to go ahead and end this. And he took out his sword to kill himself. Even those who only have a mild, small grain of salt of faith, when confronted with difficult things, will at least cry out to God. At least, God help me. Something like that. We'll at least cry out. This guy said, life's over. I'm out. He has no desire for any type of spiritual aspect of his life. He couldn't be more opposite of Lydia than anybody else we can find. And yet, while he's ready to kill himself, Paul cries out and says, do yourself no harm. Jailer calls for the lights, fire, to be turned on so they can see, right? And when he finds all of them there, and that not a single prisoner is left, he looks at Paul and Silas and says, I want what you have. He wasn't in a position to be told about grace, to be told about mercy, in the same way that Lydia had her heart, had her ears, had her eyes open, and the very mention of mercy and grace, she's converted. The jailer had to see it. He had to see what it looks like in real time, in real action. He wasn't ready to have a conceptual conversation about this. He didn't want to sit down and talk about the prophets or talk about, you know, all the things that would have happened and how these events unfolded. Jailer didn't want any part of that. To put it a different way, the jailer wanted to see before he believed. So we've got a stark contrast, right, to the first two converts here in Philippi. The first converts in the entire continent of Europe. We got one who's searching and one who has no idea. But let's look at some things that are similar between both of them. Both, regardless of the experience, had to be taught. I find it very interesting that a lot of people today will tell you that you have to have a salvation experience. Something has to happen to you. You have to be moved by the Spirit or caught up speaking in tongues or a myriad of other things. You have to have this experience. But I want you to notice with both of these characters that we meet, while something happened, the truth is what they needed before they could react. While she was there and listened and understood about the prophets and about Jesus and who he was and what he had done, her heart, eyes, and mind were open. The jailer, because he saw mercy and grace extended to him when they didn't have to. Remember, he's just the guy that roughed him up and put him in the inner part of the prison yesterday. And not only are Paul and Silas there, but all these other prisoners are there too, and nobody left. And the jailer in his mind is thinking, you guys didn't have to do this. Not only did you not have to do it, you probably shouldn't have done it, because when the doors are opened of the prison, there's a reason we got locks on them to keep them inside. There's no locks, everything's wide open, and yet all of you stayed. Jailer says, I've got to change because I see my life next to your life. I'm hopeless. You're hopeful. I got to change. But yet, he couldn't do anything, right? He couldn't do anything until they told him why they believed, what they believed, and what he needed to do in order to be saved. Now, we're not given a diatribe here in Acts chapter 16 about exactly what they taught him. I don't know what all they went through. I don't know if they started all the way back in Genesis 1 and talked to him about who God was and why he was the God, and then about Jesus, his son, and all of, I don't know what all they talked to him about. But look at his reaction. In verse 33, he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds. What do you think he learned about? I don't know if they talked to him about how Jesus washed the disciples' feet, about service, about humility, about, I don't know what they talked about, but it moved him so much that his reaction is, I got to try and make what happened to you yesterday right. Was it the jailer's place to apologize? Nope. Jailer didn't have anything to do with it. Jailer wasn't the one that beat him. Jailer wasn't the one that ordered them to be beaten. Jailer's just the one that locked them up. But listen to the jailer's response. I've got to try and fix this. And the jailer, he's wanting to let him out in the morning. Remember how kind of the story ends? And they say, wait a minute, we're Roman citizens. We want to talk to the guys that did this. You're not going to sneak us out in the middle of the night. They were taught and they responded. They understood what the message of the gospel was and they reacted to it. Both of them baptized, washed away their sins, died to Jesus, died to the old man, raised to newness of life. Notice, secondly, that they didn't do it alone. They didn't do it alone. With Lydia, her and her household, the jailer, he and his household. That speaks to two things. The first is influence. That you have enough influence over your household that when you make a decision, they care about it, they respect it, and they want to follow. Now, do I think for a moment that Lydia was converted and went back and told the kids, hey, we're all going to get baptized today? No, that's not what happened. Everyone in the household was taught the same way Lydia was taught. Everyone in the jailer's house was taught the same way the jailer was taught. And all of them made individual decisions about Jesus and about their own salvation. But it was based on the recommendation of the jailer and of Lydia. They came and said, this guy is for real and he speaks for God. Listen to what he has to say. Both them and their household, they included everybody that was around them. So it speaks not only to influence, but also desire. They thought enough about what had just happened that they wanted the same thing for everybody that they knew, especially those that were closest to them. Sometimes I wonder within ourselves, when we're converted, when we change, when we make these large changes in our lives, do we have the same desire to make sure everybody else knows about it? Or do we immediately begin to write them off? Do we say, I need to tell everybody I know, or do we start to disqualify them? Like, yeah, I'd talk to Uncle Bob, but you know, Uncle Bob's probably not into this. Let's try. And we just start immediately saying, no, they're probably not going to want to hear it. They got their own thing going. But they had a desire. They wanted those closest to them, those that they loved, to hear the gospel, to make a decision about it. They wanted to tell their story. Did they know enough about the books of the Bible or marriage, divorce, and remarriage or all these other complicated things that we think we need to know before we can teach others? Nope. Couldn't have. All they knew was, this is real and we need to look at it. That's what they knew. And their families were converted. Thirdly, both immediately desired to show hospitality. Hospitality is about appreciation. It's about thanks. What they wanted to do is, you've changed my life. Let me do something to try and repay you. Let me do something to help you out on your journey. Let me do something to be involved in the work of the gospel. I don't know anything, but what little bit I got, you're welcome to. Come to the house. Both of them immediately wanted to show appreciation. I'm persuaded that that's really all hospitality is appreciation. We open our homes and our lives to those that we appreciate the relationships with. Those that we're fond of, that we care about, that we want to help in some way, form, or fashion. That's why we do it. And I would argue that if you're not one that practices a lot of hospitality and you struggle with that, I'm going to tell you it's because maybe you don't appreciate your brothers and sisters enough. The more you appreciate them, the more you appreciate the family of God, the relationships you have, the love that you have for each other, the more you're going to be willing to open the door. And the less you're going to care about all the reasons why you don't. Less you're going to care about whether or not the house is clean, or whether or not the stuff's picked up, or whether or not it's nice enough, or whatever else we tell ourselves. Of all the reasons why we can't, couldn't, wouldn't, shouldn't. The more we appreciate each other, the more we want to have those relationships and deepen those relationships. The Jews and Lydia both wanted a deep relationship with Paul. They wanted a relationship with those that were spreading the gospel. They said, let us be involved with this. Let us help. Let us do something. Neither one, before they met Paul, had an opportunity to prepare their houses either. Just want to throw that out there. They didn't know he was coming over. It was an immediate reaction. Providence played a key role in both of these two. The providence of the jailer to be in that position when Paul and Silas get locked up. The providence of all of the criminals, not one of them running. Not one of them. You would think there's at least one joker that would have took off, right? But the entire prison was in awe of the earthquake that happened, of the fact that the doors were open, of the fact that these guys that are in the middle of the prison were singing and praying all night long. Everybody stopped. That moment created an opportunity for Paul and Silas to show mercy, to show grace to the jailer. The moment of providence allowed the jailer to make a decision about Jesus. The same thing in the case with Lydia. Of all of her travels, of all of the places, the fact that she desired to come and to worship was the opportunity that she had to make a decision about Jesus. Of course, my last slide's not going to work. Let me move back over here. In conclusion, what does all this mean, right? I think when we take a look at both of these cases, when we compare them, when we contrast them, when we look at what happened with Lydia, the most important thing I want you to know is providence is real. And it still works today. Maybe the reason why you ended up in this congregation through all the twists and turns you've had in your life, what brought you here versus anywhere else, maybe there's a reason why you're here. That reason is to do something, to encourage somebody, to have an opportunity to make a decision about Jesus or to help somebody else do that. To be the Paul and Silas to the Philippian jailer. To extend mercy and grace where mercy and grace isn't due. To show love and to show compassion. Because that grace, that mercy, that love, that's what changes hearts today. there's different type of people in the world. There's some people that are looking, and there's some people that have no desire to look. Right? Lydia was looking. She was faithful. She was devout. She was worshiping, even in a small group far away from home. The jailer had no desire or interest of spiritual things. Right? Both were impacted. Both's lives changed forever. Both appreciated everything that was done. We're going to find Lydia's in our life, and we're going to find jailers in our life. What our choice is to have our eyes open enough to see that we can't convert Lydia the same way we convert the jailer. Right? The jailer had to see it. Lydia wanted to hear it. If Lydia would have been there with an earthquake with a bunch of criminals, she would have freaked out and ran. The jailer needed to see it. She needed to hear it. She needed to be at a place of worship. Third, our role in the gospel is to always be teaching. Now, what do I mean when I say that? Our teaching takes a bunch of different forms. Sometimes it's the things that we say, but most of the time it's the things that we do. We sing a song about being the world's Bible. It's our lives. It's the way that we act and react. It's what people see when we have to put our faith in action. And what do people see when they look at your life? When they see you, if you walked around with one of those GoPro cameras on you all the time, and we were playing back the video, what would people see? And based on that video, could they quickly determine whether or not you had a faith and belief and trust in God, or whether you were just like everybody else? What would they see at your life, at my life? Would they see an opportunity to change, to be different? Because really, that's what happened with the jailer, right? He set his life against Paul and Silas's and said, I want what they got. Lydia, as she searched, as she tried to find God, said, there's God, I finally found him. And she changed everything. Some are searching, and some need some instruction. And they're going to ask you some questions, and they're going to be there at worship services, and they're going to be there in Bible classes, and we have got to be in a position to help them. But others, it's all action. We never know what that cup of cold water, handshake, hug, kind word of encouragement, we never know where any of that stuff leads. It's hard for me to talk about providence and not think about Joseph. The entire life of Joseph is about providence. But one of the things that's always fascinated me about that story is that as he's in jail, he's in jail after he ran away from Potiphar's wife and she lied on him. Remember, this guy's in jail and the two servants of Pharaoh come in jail, and what's his initial interaction with them? Why the long face? What are you guys sad about? Because we're in jail. That's why we're sad, because we're in jail. You should be sad too. It's a place of sadness. We're not having a birthday party down here. It's jail. Yet, his choice was to have an effect regardless of his circumstances. Friends, we've got to not let our circumstances define who we are. We have to define our circumstances. We have a choice we can make. We can choose to be a victim of our circumstances and woe is me and lay in the fetal position in the middle of the floor. Or we can say, regardless of my circumstances, I believe and trust what I believe and trust. And God's going to take care of this on the other side, whether I understand and know it or not, whether I know how the math is going to work out. I know that God's going to see me through because he always has. And I've got a list of characters that he's always seen through. So I'm going to choose to not only make the best out of this, but I'm going to choose to affect others through it. While being false imprisoned, he was worried about why people were sad. Just think about that. Providence at work, grace and mercy affect lives, and thirdly, we got to understand what we're doing here. We've got to take opportunities to teach in our actions and our lives that we live. And when we have an opportunity to open our mouths, got to open that mouth. And if all you can tell somebody to do is what you did, that's good. That's enough. You don't have to get into all the deep-rooted things of this. I think sometimes we convince ourselves that we need to know more than we need to know. And that's just not the truth. What you need to know in order to become a Christian is you've messed some stuff up, God's going to fix it, and how God fixes it. That's all you need to know. Baseline, that's all you need to know. You need to know those three things. Once you know those three things, then you can react to it. If you've messed some stuff up, God wants to fix it. That's where this providence works out. Maybe you're here this morning because you needed to hear that. Maybe you're here this morning because you've messed a bunch of stuff up and you have no idea how to get out of it, but God does. God can get you out and God can see you through. Third, how God fixes it. God fixes it when you trust in Him, when you leave everything else behind, you confess in His Son, you die with Him in the waters of baptism, and you rise to take hold of newness of life. All your sins are gone. You're new. You're a brand new creature, ready to take hold of newness of life. That's how God fixes stuff. If you are a child of God, but you've fallen back away, you've started messing some stuff up again, God's still here to fix it. God didn't leave. And as much of a wreck of their lives as the Israelites made, as David made, as Saul made, as Saul of Tarsus made, I mean, we can go on and on down the list. A bunch of people did a bunch of stuff worse than you did, I'll promise you. God still wants to fix it. He wants to fix you. But the choice is ours. Maybe you're here this morning because you've got some things in your life that need to be fixed. Let us help you. That's what the family of God does. We're here to help in whatever way we can to put you back on the right track, to get you back connected to God. If we can learn anything from the case of conversion here in Lydia, it's that when you come to see God, you'll find Him. When you come and you desire to worship and you want to find out some things about God, you're going to find Him. And we're here to help you do that in any way we can. Whatever we can do to help you, come forward now as we stand and sing.